You are listening to Queer Review on CHRW 94.9. Queer Review is in association with the Pride Library, and our radio show broadcasts every other Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. To find out more, visit chrwradio.com and queerreviewradio.blogspot.com.
London, Ontario. Boomtown. Boom. Look at the beautiful places. Here and here. Such a pretty church. Pretty beautiful. The straightest sidewalks you've ever seen. The locals are surely attractive. All the latest fashions are at their fingertips. The backbone of industry. What we need more of. Tanks, beer, cookies, Kellogg's. Eat up, London, Ontario. Delightful. Here is Joe London, going off to the local factory, while his wife, Lily, shops in the interesting boutiques. Fantastic. Set your dreams down in London, Ontario. A good place to live.
You are listening to Queer Review on CHRW 94.9. Today I'm introducing our guest, Ben Benedict, a London organizer, community organizer, a host of Rainbow Radio Network, which airs on 10 p.m. on Monday nights, and Inside the Arts, which is Tuesdays at 11 a.m. here on CHRW Radio 94.9. So tune in for that. How do you do, Ben?
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. I will say the Inside the Arts is the third Tuesday, so it's a once-a-month deal, and Rainbow Radio is every Monday, but I'm not the guest. There's a multiple guest there as well. So, yes, thank you. Lots of things going on.
Great. I want to start off, I have a few things to talk to you about, but I'd like to start off with your involvement in the founding and running of the Pride Festival here in London. Could you talk a little bit about what your involvement has been over time?
Well, good question. Let's go back to Western. I came here in 88, and at the time, James Miller, who runs and had created the Pride Library, had UW out, and it was very militant. I wasn't ready to be out then. So I came out very, very later in life. I was 34 at the time. I was living in Sarnia. And during that process, Sarnia was creating its first Pride. So I got involved there. So I actually created Sarnia's first ever Pride. And that's going to come, we're going to come back to that later, because that's going to lead into this book project we're going to be discussing. So I came back to London in 2000, wanted to get involved with the Pride group here. And it didn't really go off very well, which led to my creating a Pride London Festival along with Dan Steele and Mike Terrell. Because in 2002, those people who I had approached to join Pride in 2000 ended up taking the money, the profit, and divvying it up and disappearing, basically leaving Halo, the sponsoring organization, without money for Pride. So come 2002, because of that, they were going to really downsize it. Danny, Michael, and myself really felt that our community deserved to continue moving forward rather than going back into the closet. So we incorporated Pride at the time and sort of maintained it at the level that it's been as a community festival as opposed to just a community event.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the festival has evolved over time? You were mentioning earlier that it has changed in a progressive way to being broader and larger.
Right. Well, to do that, you have to understand gay history. And maybe that sort of leads, again, back into the book. You know, in 1969 in New York was the drag riots, where police would go into regularly into gay establishments, beat up the clientele, rob, you know, harass gay and lesbian members of the community in New York State. And that sort of led to the drag up queen revolt, which led to Pride. So in 1982, London held its first Pride event. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, formed in 1974, the first LGBT group in Canada, if not all of North America, to form. So 8 years later, 1982, following the bathhouse raids in Toronto, where similar in 1969, police were harassing gay establishments in Toronto, there was a provincial, if not national-wide, revolt, which created Pride here in London in 1982 through the Metropolitan Community Church. and then Halo got involved, and it began to grow right up to that 2002 point. So it had grown to being recognized. So when we stepped in at that time, we wanted to maintain that festival attitude. So from that point on, so when now we're talking 2002, it's become recognized as a key festival for our community, London in general, not just the gay community, but all of London. It celebrates diversity, and I've been talking about diversity more and more. And not only is it now a festival, but it's also a cultural event. So over the past years, we've had film events, theater events, literary readings, and the art show, which I've coordinated for the last 10 years. And in that, we've taken that from just a local hang work on your art by on the walls by friends and people you know, to it's now juried provincial wide. And this year I've got an international artist as well as an Aboriginal artist from Saskatchewan. So it hits all those key important factors in the arts community as well.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the politics was like and how this is creating history for London? The Pride Festival in general, how it affects history and politics and your involvement with all these issues.
You know, part of the original history was at the time in the late 90s, we had a mayor called Diane Haskett, and Diane was adamant that she didn't support Pride because of her Christian beliefs. And I think in that adversity, that's created a strength and a desire and willingness for Pride in the community to band together. So how has it changed? Well, when I first started doing this, you might see a couple of women walking hand in hand on a rarity. Now I've seen young men walking down the street hand in hand. Now we still experience a lot of violence. London has been recognized as the hate crime capital, so there's more violence, domestic violence and domestic toward violence towards LGBT members here in London than anywhere else in Canada. So there's still a lot of work to be done about tolerance and acceptance and you know, livability for the LGBT community here in London, but we've come an awful long way.
Would you like to talk a little bit more about the art festival and your involvement in that aspect of the festival?
Well, as an artist, I mean, that's part. I also do public relations and corporate communication. So I think my two big contributions, other than simply creating Pride London Festival as an event organization, as a nonprofit that brings people from the community in to mentor and train them and give them some skills on behalf of the community, I've created the Pride Guide Community Directory. So there was a guide. I've added this community directory because when I, in 2002, realized there was no listing of where you would go. As a gay member, where would you go for services? And there was no listing here about Pride Western, the health unit, Halo, ACOL at the time, the Regional HIV AIDS Coalition. So if you were gay and you're coming out, you were sort of lost. So we helped create that. And then on the flip side with the art show, it's about normalcy. Not all artists who are gay make art that deals with their sexuality. So it's about saying that we're just people who happen to be gay. And even that whole concept of gay homosexuality is relatively new in the world. I mean, it's only been the last 150 years where sexuality has been divided into sectors of straight, gay, bi, trans. You know, at one point in time, there was a far greater fluidity. And I think you find that in a lot of sectors of life, science, for example, in the last 100 years, it used to be just medicine, science. And now there's, you know, podiatrists, there's gynecologists, there's oncologists. Those labels never existed 100 years ago. So we're a society that is really slicing up life by definition. And the gay community is no different. You know, the leather bears, the lipstick lesbians, you know, all those sort of various labels. It's acrimonious, but at the same time, one of the first things I discovered in my coming out process and in really not embracing sex with men, but embracing my sexuality and the community that revolved around that was understanding that regardless of who you are and what you want out of life, there's someone else out there. And the community is, for the most part, very tolerant and accepting of your exploration to try and find that particular interest, whether you're a bear, a twink, or, you know, whatever your sexual preference is as a person, there's something compatible out there for you.
Yes. So can you tell us briefly what your book project is?
Having created Pride and worked in it for a number of years, recently the London Heritage Council has come up with, it's called CHIP, the funding program to look at London's culture. So funding cultural festivities and activities within London proper. And last year, their first year, they granted money to an author to do history on London, a research project on London's history. Well, last summer, we were talking about that at another nonprofit event with the director of the Heritage Council, Andrea Hallam, and I was talking about Pride to her and also the Trillium Foundation about how we can build and take Pride to the next level. And we were talking about the history of the organization, and Andrea said, well, why don't you apply for a grant? And it's just like, boom, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. Yes, why don't I? Because of my position in the community as a writer and as an artist and as a creator of the event, as well as when I was in Sarnia, I spoke on the steps of City Hall about the history of gay and lesbian history in Sarnia Lambton. And if Sarnia Lambton has a rich, diverse gay history, I can only imagine what London is going to be like. And we've talked a little bit about that. So it's really documenting that history, because in 2011, London was designated the hate crime capital of Canada. So if we don't claim our history as women and visible minorities have, you know, that won't be there. So how can we stand up against bullies and say, you know, that our lives have value when we can't illustrate the history that we brought to this community? And there's a lot of adversity, you know. Go back in history in 1880s when Oscar Wilde was the first person charged with indecent acts for homosexuality. And it really was more about politics than his sexuality. He was a poor avant-garde artist who took up with a very rich young man whose father was in government at the time and took offense to his young son taking up with an older man. And we still see a lot of those prejudices today. Now, move forward 50, 70 years to the 1950s, then you got in J. Edgar Hoover and McCarthyism in the U.S., where, you know, homosexuality was vilified along with communism and you know, outcasts, social outcasts. So rather than being, you know, recognized as the spinster marm, the school marm, you know, the women who taught your children who never married, or the bachelor, you know, the dandy, the gentleman bachelor who probably in all likelihood was gay but never married or never took up with gentlemen. But, you know, there were private clubs. Even here in London, there's stories of and I forget the exact name of the establishment, but you used to knock on the back door, and in the private gentleman's club, there was a room where men would misbehave. You know, those stories are out there, but they're not really collated in any one particular place. And unless we do that now, we're going to lose that history. A gentleman just recently passed away and, you know, never came out, but there are suspicions that he was a gay man, lived into his 90s, but he passed away a week ago. And so we've lost not just that history, but his recollections of the history before. So we've lost 150 years of history. You know, there's other gentlemen in their 80s now, and if we don't collect that oral history now, we're going to lose a great deal of who we are as a community. And I think that's the important aspect to remember in all of this. So there's two aspects of the book project. One is the research project, going through the Richard Hullard archives. And Richard is the founder, one of the founders of HALO, and as well as the oral history of those who are still alive here, because if we don't collect those stories, they'll be lost forever.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you already know about gay history, and what you've found and what you are going to be looking into when you sit down to actually sift through it all and write this book?
Okay, well, gay, homosexual, the whole thing, you got to take it right back. The first terminology, the first use of the word homosexuality was in the 1850s. It originated in Germany. It wasn't used again until the 1880s with Oscar Wilde, and it wasn't really coined, really wasn't recognized until about 1920s, 1910, 1920, when Sigmund Freud started to talk about sexuality, and homosexuality and delayed development
neurosis.
Yes, and it wasn't necessarily neurosis. I don't think so. It wasn't a malcontent. We know more about the brain and psychology today, and I say, yes, a lot of gay men and women do suffer from arrested development, but because at the time of puberty, when you're realizing who you are as a sexual being, you're being inundated with images of the other, being heterosexuality, and that at the for years, until very recently, there weren't images of homosexuality or normalcy of sexuality in the media. It was all deviance. You were married with two kids, the Ozzy and Harriet scenario, right? And unless you conform to those sort of American ideal dream, which is really a lie, you were outcast. And society was really meant to put people in a box, and it really was about commercialism as opposed to anything else. So there's all those little narratives behind the scenes. But when it talks about individuals, you sort of erase all those narratives and you talk about the individual stories. And those, it's that individual story, the collective here in the community. You know, what was it like, you know, living that lie for years? You know, gay marriage when in the 1990s, when the gay marriage was finally accepted here in Canada, you know, over the last 10 years, it's decimated a lot of very aspects of the gay community, because at the time, you know, married men, you know, you were gay, you married, you had kids, you know, and you lived a separate life. That was the norm, because that was the world, the straight world allowed you to have. You could play their lies and you could have your thing on the side. So there's with normalcy of homosexuality, there's a whole group of bisexual and older gay men who seem to be lost in the world. The park scene, you know, the public washroom scene, all those sort of idiosyncrasies where sex would happen and men would meet were gone, because you didn't need it anymore. In fact, gay bars here in London, there used to be 3 or 4. Now we're down to 1.5 type thing. And they're only open period because most don't need to go to a gay bar to meet other gay people. You go to a club and you meet the metrosexual, and who knows who you're going to come home with that night. So the world has changed, and that's part of that evolving history. There's the social elements and the public elements, but there's also the individual private elements, and sort of getting at that through first oral stories. So I'm hoping to interview someone in their 80s and as many of those as possible, but as well as younger people in their 20s, because when you look at the dichotomy between those two generations and their life experiences, that's going to show that transition.
It seems like it would be difficult to get a official history of gay history previous to the last 30 years.
Well, yes, because the Hutter archives begin in 1974. So prior to that, it's going to be a challenge. And that's why the oral history is so important, especially from older men. Like I said, we just lost a gentleman in his 90s. And I for this project and for the history of London's community, it's a horrible, horrible loss. Not only just losing a wonderful gentleman, but as well as the history that he carried with him. So, yeah, that is important. The other aspect, though, is doing actually pure hardcore research. There's the Gay and Lesbian Archives in Toronto, you know, there's Pride Library here, but it's reaching out, and this is where it gets expensive, and this is why we're waiting for this grant. The CHIP grant will be announced in the next 2 weeks. Is that you have to advertise, you have to let people know you're doing the project, and then you have to ask. So I'm hoping to do about 40 interviews of individuals, but also digging in the archives of the Halo archives, Richard Hudler's archives, talking to Richard, but then looking at the text. You know, recently, a woman in Halifax released a book on gay maritime history. So people are beginning to take this interest, and so we're really at the cutting edge of that. So that's the other challenge, right? Not a lot of research is done. What about the LGBT Aboriginal history prior to, you know, John Graves Simcoe in 1793 saying, I want to build the capital of Canada here on the Forks of the Thames? Well, that never happened. Were there any gay men or bi men, or, you know, because sexuality was more fluid, traveling with Simcoe at the time? What was the Aboriginal responses, you know, and since the first part of the 1800s through to 1900, you know, where's the history there? I'm sure there was one, but how are you going to find that? Because again, you know, there was no word for it, mm-hmm. You know, so maybe there was slang at the time. So it's looking for those little idiosyncrasies and not searching mainstream text, but alternative text, if they survive, because a lot of this would have been printed on non-archival paper, you know, and you know, unless they were buried in someone's archive somewhere, you know, and I even know that's the stuff families don't keep. You know, you come across your uncle's archives and papers and you find out that he was gay. You know, you don't keep that stuff. Most people, right up to very recently, threw all that stuff away. you know, even my grandfather, when he died, and he wasn't gay, but he was a very interesting gentleman. My family threw all his papers out before I got a chance to collect them. And it was a real heartbreak. And I think that happens in far too many individual families. And so there's a multitude of reasons why this project needs to proceed. You know, the gay booksellers have closed. You know, even the normal, regular, run-of-the-mill heterosexual booksellers have really pared down their LGBT-ish sections. So we as a community aren't even getting the positive resources anymore because bookstores aren't carrying them. And what does that mean? What does that say? I'm not sure. But, I mean, those are some of the challenges, finding contemporary texts, finding authors who are working in similar veins, not for London specifically, because that's a specific, but also more the generalized history and how that relates. So we want to talk about the funding. It's $10,000 that'll pay me to feed myself over 3 to 6 months, but as well pay for photocopying, archiving, marketing, because one of the things will be necessary is in magazines like Outlooks, Fab Magazine, and Extra Magazine out of Toronto, Calgary, Vancouver, is advertising in those products, promoting the project, and asking people who have lived in London or have relatives who have photos of their gay uncle, their gay aunt from the turn of the century, to send them in, to write up their stories, to consent to be interviewed. Because the interviewing process, you know, if you're 80 or even if you're 20, you know, it's a very lengthy process. So it's taking that oral history, recording it, putting it into a text form, and then editing it. It's a very, very weighty project.
What kind of effect do you hope that this book will have on London gay community and wherever it spreads out?
Well, you know, thank the women's movement and you know, the black movement, the visible minority movement, it's all about acceptance and tolerance, but also for young people coming out. You know, there's, I guess, a sort of naivety that, you know, because the world is more tolerant and accepting of your sexuality now, it was always that way. You know, you could always marry. And for the Twitterverse, you know, it always has been. It has always been like that. So we got a whole generation of young men and women who don't really necessarily understand the history and the adversity. You know, the fact that, you know, many gay men were dragged out and beaten to death in the street, you know, were shot, maimed, you know, awful things done, you know, and some of that in our lifetime, but 10 times worse in the generation before. That really created a sense of fear. And hopefully it's about alleviating that sense of fear and giving young men and women hope that their future can be better, you know, that they don't have to suffer the atrocities of the past. But as well, understanding that, you know, there was a lot of men and women who put their life and their values on the line, like our veterans who go to war. We talk about service that they provided. Well, there were a lot of gay men and women who went to war, who came back and didn't have the same rights they fought for. You know, so that's an important story. Mm-hmm. You know, same with our Aboriginal population. You know, many Aboriginals fought in World War II, and they came back to a society that completely disavowed their contributions. So it's about writing that history partially while giving the next generation hope and a sense of values that their past means something.
Who in London do you think really stands out as a warrior for gay rights?
No one. I mean, that's one of the problems within the community. I've been doing this for 10 years. I would say James Miller has, with the Pride Library, has done a phenomenal job. But to be that advocate, you know, it's...
Richard Hudler, maybe, is the other.
Well, Richard now lives in Toronto, and Richard's been retired, right, for about, I would say, mid-90s. Mm-hmm. So as James was really being that leading voice here and bringing positive space to Western, Richard was retiring, donated to archives to help create the library, actually. And then, you know, I've been doing it. I know there's been a few individuals, but no one's really, really stepped up to the plate. Daniel Pugh with the Regional HIV AIDS Coalition now is formed the HPT Working Group, Anti-Homophobic, Biphobic, and Transphobic Working Group. They're beginning to take a stand, but that's a real challenge around leadership. And it's not just, London's gay community, it's the arts community, it's visible minorities. Finding leadership in this community is very, very difficult because we're really are, you go to work, come home, sit on your couch, watch TV type of community. We've had that reputation and maybe call it conservatism. I would just say it's sort of laid back, casual, as opposed to conservatism. And so again, but there's a greater challenge, right? Because people, even the gay community from Toronto, people move here because it is a quiet neighborhood. You can live, you know, next to a mixed race couple, you know, gay couple, you know, your average 2.5 kids family. They can all live on the same block and live peacefully and cohabitate, you know, together. They may talk behind each other's backs, but they'll at least wave and be smiling and not burn each other's houses down, you know, in the middle of the night. So we have progressed a long way. But London really is that misanthrope of everything. You know, in 1990, they did a campaign called London All Mixed Up. Unfortunately, it was at a time when council was mixed up and not really focused, so it didn't go very far. But we really are that multicultural, diverse community with a little bit of everything.
If anyone would like to get in contact with you about your upcoming project, how can they do that?
That's a good question. I will probably be setting up a separate email, but right now my main email is info, I-N-F-O, at Be Creative. That's BCREATIVE.ca. That's my website, BeCreative.ca, for my writings. You know, I'm working on updating that. I'm also working on a new website for my artwork, because I got a show in Ingersoll this summer. Give that a plug. At the Creative Arts Center from July 10th to August 28th, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 2 to 4. Thank you. So they can email me, but yeah, I'll be making that a little more visible. And so I'll be putting up notices in the Pride Library. It really depends on that funding, though. And James been a big supporter. So one way or another, we'll probably start looking at the project, whether the funding arrives this time or not. I think we've got a good start on it.
Well, good luck with your entire project, and thank you for coming in today.
Oh, thanks, John, and I want to thank James Miller for his support. Deb Alhazem from Pride London Festival also wrote a letter of support, and Phil McLeod, my former editor at The Londoner, who also wrote a letter of support. So I've got a lot of support for the project, and it looks like the community is going to be behind it. There's a lot of interest brewing. I've been asked to sit in on a couple other things just as word of mouth starts spreading about the project. So I'm positive that it will go forward. Keep my fingers crossed. You people out there, keep your fingers crossed too. You know, if you can have any influence at the Heritage Council, please do. If you're on the juror, please consider our application. And thank you for helping promote the project.